Welcome to the CDH Conversations podcast. We record this podcast as part of our Beyond 16 Days podcast series, and this is the second part of our Pride in Practice conversation. I'm Brigitte Mangale, a director in our pro bono and human rights practice based in Cape Town. With me today are my colleagues Elgene Ruiz, a senior associate in our practice, and our CA, Simonuko Klebart. In episode one, we explained the legal framework that informs LGBTQIA plus rights in South Africa. Today, we're taking the conversation further, right to the heart of the 16 Days of Activism campaign.
The 16 Days of Activism for No Violence Against Women and Children campaign runs annually from the 25th of November to the 10th of December. This campaign is a call for global solidarity to end violence against women and children everywhere. But we also know that members of the LGBTQIA plus community experience violence, and that violence is often deeply gendered. In this episode, we explore where LGBTQIA plus lives fit into South Africa's GBVF crisis. The theme for this year's 16 Days of Activism campaign is Unite to End Digital Violence Against All Women and Girls. It's a focus on the growing issue of technology-facilitated gender-based violence, which includes various forms of digital violence, such as image-based abuse, cyberbullying, online harassment, AI-generated abuse, online stalking, and grooming, among others. This campaign is significant in highlighting the urgent need for digital safety and the requirement for a rigorous regulatory framework that protects vulnerable groups from online harm. So, Elgene, please tell us more about South Africa's theme for this campaign this year.
South Africa's theme for the 2025 16 Days campaign is Letsema, Men, Women, Boys and Girls Work Together to End Gender-Based Violence and Femicide. This theme reaches across the gender spectrum, calling for all to work together to tackle the growing problem of GBVF. On 21 November 2025, the nation united in a powerful national shutdown to confront the alarming and escalating rates of GBVF. Women and members of the LGBTQIA plus community were called upon to step away from all paid and unpaid work and to refrain from spending for the day. An act designed to highlight the profound social and economic impact of GBVF. Many also wore black and joined a 15-minute standstill at noon, a collective moment of mourning the lives lost to GBVF. This mobilization prompted a significant political response. At the G20 Social Summit, the presidency declared GBVF a national crisis. Subsequently, the Minister of Cooperative Governance and Traditional Affairs announced that GBVF had been formally designated a national disaster, noting that it meets the threshold of a potential disaster as defined by the Disaster Management Act. Brigitte, given this national recognition of GBVF as a crisis and now declared disaster, in your view, what are the deepest structural and societal forces that underpin this crisis, particularly for women and members of the LGBTQIA plus community?
So in my view, GBVF is fundamentally about power and control. It's underpinned by the harmful enforcement of patriarchal gender norms that prescribe a cisgender heteronormative way of being. So where women are targeted because of their womanhood, queer people are also targeted because of their gender and or their sexuality. Their identities or relationships are seen to challenge and therefore violate gender norms, and the performance of gender and violence functions as a punishment meant to enforce conformity. So for example, lesbian and bisexual women face what's known as corrective rape, often expressed as a tool to quote-unquote fix them. Transgender women experience high rates of violence for many reasons, including because perpetrators view their existence as a threat to masculinity. This shows that violence against the LGBTQIA plus community is not separate from gender-based violence and femicide, but is a direct expression of the power and patriarchal control that fuels violence against cisgender women.
You're right, Brigitte. And this allows us to think about intersectionality. While GBVF affects many women, and as you've said, it affects women because of their gender and also their sexuality or identity, it also affects Black queer women disproportionately. So GBVF cannot be eradicated unless we consider its impact on women who are also lesbian, bisexual, gender nonconforming, intersex or transgender, and also Black women. And this violence is not only physical. It includes acts like misgendering or the enforcement of gendered dress codes. It also includes violations of human rights, such as refusal to healthcare or police refusing to open cases of GBVF, or even shelters turning trans people away. Non-binary people also experience pressure to conform to binary notions of gender.
And I think this is why it is so important to raise awareness, not only of these issues, but also of the legal tools available to address them. Now, in our last episode, we briefly discussed legislation such as the Promotion of Equality and the Prevention of Unfair Discrimination Act, also known as PAPUDA. Today, let's dive into the Prevention and Combating of Hate Crimes and Hate Speech Act, which was signed into law in 2024. The Act sets out several key objectives: to prevent hate crimes and hate speech, to combat their commission in a coordinated and effective manner, and to provide for the prosecution and appropriate sentencing of individuals who commit offences under this Act. Crucially, the Act recognises that a hate crime is not a standalone offence, but rather an underlying act committed with a prejudicial or intolerant motive. Such prejudice may be based on characteristics such as gender, sex, sexual orientation, gender identity or expression, or sex characteristics, among others. Section 3(2) of the Act provides that any person who commits a hate crime is liable on conviction to a penalty as contemplated by the Criminal Procedure Act for the underlying crime. However, because the offence is also a hate crime, the court imposing the sentence must consider the hate crime as an aggravating circumstance when imposing a sentence. Additionally, the criminal record of the perpetrator must reflect the underlying offence as a hate crime.
So just to make sure we're understanding correctly, are you saying that a hate crime is not a newly created offence, but rather an offence based on the motivation of another already existing crime?
That's correct, Brigitte. A hate crime is a crime that is motivated by hate or intolerance. For example, assault is defined in the common law as the intentional and unlawful application of force to the person of another. But if someone commits an assault because the other person is a lesbian woman, for example, and that assault is motivated by the perpetrator's homophobia and misogyny, the hate becomes a hate crime.
Thank you for that example, Eljean. This ties perfectly into the GBVF conversation. Much of the violence that queer people face is gender-based. Now there is legal recognition for the prejudice behind it. But we do need to be realistic. A law is only as good as its implementation. So survivors of GBVF across the board still face ridicule or are disregarded where they should be protected from harm. For example, a matter we're working on involves the South African Police Service's failure to adhere to its own policy on the detention of transgender persons, and in contravention thereof, placing a transgender teenage girl in a holding cell with three men. She was consequently raped and sexually abused while in SAPS's custody. This goes to show that while the Act and other legal provisions and policies providing for equality and non-discrimination are important tools, none of them replace the need for training, for accountability, and systemic reform. I think that the largely visible violations are partly prevalent because those that are more difficult to see or minimized are normalized as part of the female or queer experience. They often go unchecked, like the things people say. This is why it is so important that the Hate Crimes Act furthers the framework around the prohibition of hate speech. And for a bit of background, Section 16 of the Constitution provides for the right to freedom of expression, but this right does not extend to advocacy of hatred that is based on race, ethnicity, gender, or religion, and that constitutes incitement to cause harm. This provision does not expressly provide for the right to protection against hate speech, although other constitutional rights, such as the right to dignity or equality, afford that protection. So this provision does, however, carve out what is now known as hate speech from the lawful exercise of the right to freedom of expression. It further gives us an idea that hate speech is made up of two elements: an element of intolerance on certain grounds on one hand, and an element of incitement of violence or the causing of harm. And Section 10 of PAPUDA prohibits hate speech. It provides that no person may publish, propagate, advocate, or communicate words based on one or more of the prohibited grounds against any other person. That could reasonably be construed to demonstrate a clear intention to be harmful or to incite harm or to promote or propagate hatred. This prohibition allows for a person to approach the Equality Court for civil relief.
But Section 10.2 of PAPUDA makes it clear that the civil nature of its application doesn't limit the court from referring the matter to the Director of Public Prosecutions where the hate speech also constitutes a criminal act. So is this where Section 4 of the Hate Crimes Act comes in?
Precisely, Brigitte. Section 4 of the Act expressly provides that hate speech is an offence. It goes even further. It also makes it an offence to intentionally distribute or to make available an electronic communication which one knows constitutes hate speech. So resharing or reposting hate speech online is also an offence. This is one of the important provisions that can protect women, girls, and members of the LGBTQIA+ community. But Algene, we must ask ourselves, who are the key role players here and what can they do?
I think we all are. On the 20th of November, 2025, the Department of Women, Youth and Persons with Disabilities highlighted the importance of recognizing GBVF as a violation of human rights and the need to elevate the fight against GBVF as a priority that demands urgent, coordinated action across all spheres of government, civil society, the private sector, and communities. We as the legal sector have a responsibility to educate our clients and the public on the mechanisms available to enforce their rights so they have the tools and know how to use the resources at their disposal. An educated community is a strong community because it knows the protection it deserves. We also have a responsibility in modeling inclusivity internally so that we ourselves know what it takes to facilitate inclusivity. We can also advocate for our clients and use the law, like the Hate Crimes Act, to push for justice and accountability.
Yes, but we cannot do it on our own. Systemic problems need systemic solutions. It goes beyond calling on men, women, boys, and girls to tackle this problem together. It is about taking seriously the harm caused by intolerance, the imbalances of power, and quite frankly, state apathy. I think the police and prosecutors ought to be well trained on how to investigate and prosecute online violence. The online space can give people a sense of anonymity, which can in turn provide a hiding place for bad actors. We need to be able to rest assured in knowing that GBVF will not thrive in any of our spaces, not even online.
That's exactly right. It's so important that we all play our part in the fight against gender-based violence and femicide. Because gender-based violence and femicide is a crisis that exists year-round, our efforts and our contributions to its eradication must be consistent and rigorous, not just during these 16 days or during Women's Month, but throughout. It's also important for us to keep in mind that violence against the LGBTQIA+ community is also part of gender-based violence and femicide. And so, in closing, we ask that you be an ally, be involved, be heard, and be a champion for change beyond these 16 days. Thank you for joining us for this episode in our Beyond 16 Days series, part 2 of Pride in Practice. We'll see you in the next one.
The views and information expressed are those of the contributors at the time of publication and do not necessarily present those of the firm. All content is provided for general purposes only and does not constitute legal advice. We make no representations, warranties, or guarantees, whether expressed or implied, that the content on our podcast is accurate, complete, up-to-date, or reflects the current law. We accept no responsibility for any loss or damage, whether direct or consequential, arising from reliance on the information which is presented here.